Welcome to the Exodus Cry podcast, where we have honest conversations around exploitation, trafficking, sexual culture, and justice.
Today, we're honored to host Harmony Dust on the podcast, a trafficking survivor and founder of the organization Treasures, which provides support services for women who've been exploited in the sex industry. Let's dive into the episode.
Welcome to the podcast, Harmony.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're here and that we are sitting down for another conversation. You're one of the first people that I interviewed ever for my documentary work back, I think it was like 2008 when we were working on Nefarious. And I've just always really enjoyed the opportunity to just sit and talk with you. You're an amazing human leader, anti-trafficking advocate. I've learned so much from you, and I'm excited that we can talk on this podcast and that our audience is going to learn from you as well.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. And you know what? Fun fact, if I'm not mistaken, my foot is either in the trailer for your first documentary or it's in the movie or both. I can't remember, but I remember like, that's my foot.
That's funny. Yeah, it's weird with the documentaries. We go into it casting a pretty broad net. Mm-hmm. We're never fully sure what interviews are going to make it in or what really it's like how the story is going to take shape. So, your interview is one of the favorite interviews I've ever done. And yet your story, absolutely.
That's wild.
And yet your story is like very specific and didn't end up fitting in this particular story that we were telling, but it's possible that your foot did make it in.
My foot made it in.
That makes me feel better.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, I remember it because you were really going on a journey of like, you were so hungry to learn and understand what was happening, and you had just like, it had, wasn't that long ago that you had overheard Lily's conversation. You remember that whole connection?
Yep.
With Lily?
Yep.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I was in a genuinely very curious place in that season of just learning and just trying to understand the issues dealing with trafficking so much. And so I felt like you were able to provide a really interesting and unique perspective just through your own story. And yeah, like I said, we've learned a lot from you over the years. And you also are somebody who has, I feel like, gained a lot of trust and credibility from the larger movement, which is, I've come to realize, is so important to have that respect among colleagues. And so there were people back in the day when I was asking around, who should I interview? There was people who were saying, you know, you need to interview Harmony. And so, yeah, so I just really appreciate the credibility of your work and the integrity of it. And so something I wanted to just bring up is, before we start recording, we're talking about just the way that life can send you in different directions unexpectedly.
Been on the journey. Yeah.
And I'd love to just hear some perspective on that from you because, you know, in an ideal world, our life would start, you know, this way. We'd have two parents and two siblings and we'd grow up with a white picket fence and, you know, we'd have a puppy and that dog would live for 30 years and, you know, like whatever all the things are that we imagine like the perfect life to look like. When you're a child and you're growing up, you're genuinely hoping for those things. There's some healthy idealism as a child of like the newness of this beautiful world and all that we get to experience in it. And at some point along the way, tragedy hits. Something doesn't turn out the way that we imagined. Our life is invaded, intruded upon by some injustice and enough of those start to happen and it can send you into a really dark place where you think, I imagined life one way, and now it's turning out this other way, and I don't know how to reconcile that.
Yeah.
And I know for me, like being a perfectionist, it's been really hard for me to reconcile times and seasons of my life where things went, you know, I thought we were going left and things went right. And just, I guess I'm saying all this to ask a question. What I've observed in you is a person who has navigated a lot of those challenges in life, and the light has never gone out in your eyes. You have this childlike spirit and this integrity and this hopefulness about you. And I'm just curious, in your own journey,
yeah,
you know, things in your world started to crash at a fairly early age. And how have you been able to reconcile the seasons of life where things went in a wrong direction, did not turn out the way you thought?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for asking. I think it's such an important question, and it's definitely been a journey. I mean, as you know, I did not have an ideal childhood, and any kind of pictures of an ideal or happy life felt very rooted in fantasy, quite frankly. The idea that, you know, it's funny, on the way over here, I even said, who just says to themselves, like, I am going to live in a nice neighborhood. Like, I can do that. Like, it's a whole mindset, right? To think that you can have good things or deserve good things, and all, you know, having a good life felt so far from my reality. It literally felt like a fantasy. So my daydreams were very rooted in fantasy, you know? But what happened for me is when I became Christian in my early 20s, as you know, I was involved in pimp-controlled stripping. I come from a background of lots of abuse. My mother herself comes from a background of lots of trauma and abuse, and, you know, carried all of that into her parenting. And so I grew up in a household that was very chaotic and very abusive. And she struggled with drug addiction, and there was just not consistency. There was not stability. There didn't feel like there was any true, genuine hope of those things. But I dreamt of it. I dreamt of the white picket fence. I remember walking through neighborhoods and seeing I went to a party once in Hancock Park in LA, which is a very nice neighborhood in LA, and seeing families through the windows sitting at the dinner table and eating together and smiling and laughing and just thinking like, oh, I long for that. I want that. That's what I want my life to look like. But having no roadmap to get there and feeling like it was a literal impossibility. I had been for 7 years in this abusive, exploitative relationship with a person I thought was my boyfriend, but was my pimp. And when I became Christian in my early 20s and first started reading the Bible and going to church and learning about God, I have to be honest and tell you what was so compelling to me is that I found what I thought was a formula for that perfect life that I dreamt of. You know, those same kind of like ideals that are held in Christianity. I was like, yes, this is the formula for the marriage and the dog that lives to 30 years old and the kids that, you know, totally. I don't know, like, you know, just, I don't know, are perfect or yes. Whatever. And I loved that. And I just was like, you know, I was so hungry to learn. And that's one reason I went to school. I studied psychology. And, you know, one of my biggest coping mechanisms is intellectualization. And it's like, if I can just understand what went wrong, if I could just understand what mental health issues my mom was dealing with, if I could just understand what I'm facing and then figure out how to problem solve and get out of it. And so from every angle, I'm like, I'll just read all the right books, everything Dr. Henry Cloud and John Townsend wrote, and I'll go to every church service and read the Bible from front to back, and it's going to be great. And I thought it was. And you know, as you know, I was married, and it didn't turn out how I thought it would. I went to the premarital counseling. I went to the, you know, marriage connect groups, and I read the books on marriage, and we did the workbooks and all the things. And still I found myself, you know, facing divorce. And that certainly was not the last trial that I've experienced. I've experienced many trials since then. And I think the thing that really truly was an anchoring, recalibrating thought and belief system for me was this. I had a friend during that time when I was going through my first divorce, and she said, you know, the Bible says hope deferred makes the heart sick, but it also talks about hope being an anchor for our soul. And those things sound like contradictions at first. And we all know that longing of like the hope that's out of reach and, you know, the way it makes your heart feel to long for something that you can't have, right? But also hope can be a very stabilizing, anchoring thing. But the difference is where you're placing your hope. And what I realized in that season of my life, that in some ways, even though I wouldn't have realized it fully at the time, my hope was in the dream. My hope was in the perfect life. My hope was in the outcome that I hoped would happen if I did the right things and read the right scriptures and prayed the right prayers and, you know, went to the right connect groups, you know? And it was a huge slap in the face to realize that I could do all the quote unquote right things and still not have that right outcome. And I had to make a decision. Was I going to place my hope in the dream or in the giver of dreams, in God himself? And I'll never forget, I went through this moment with God where I was grieving so deeply, and I was like wailing and crying, and God, the cry of my heart was, God, it didn't turn out how I thought it would. It didn't turn out how I thought it would. And he let me have all my time and all my grieving and all, you know, went through all of that. And then I finally felt like I heard him say to me, I rescued you. And I was like, what? Like, nothing about what I'm going through feels like rescue. I'm divorced. I'm a single mom. I'm trying to run a ministry. Like, this does not feel like rescue. I feel like abandoned and, you know, nothing but rescue. I mean, nothing like rescue. And he said, I rescued you from your version of the dream, and I will redeem the dream. And that became such an anchoring hope for me. And then again in my life, I thought I saw the redemption of the dream. And it again didn't turn out how I thought it would. But here's at the end of the day, here's what I know, that I know, that I know, that I know, that God is good. And life has continued to throw me curveballs. And there is nothing about this journey that has looked like how I thought it would. And I have to consistently place my hope in God, because when it goes wrong again, and it has, and it will, I still have that conviction that my hope needs to be in God, and he's the redeemer of dreams. And my story is not over yet, and my story is not finished yet. And now as I get older and I've been walking with him long enough to go through enough trials, and there have been so many, I can still stand here with the knowing that God has delivered me so many times before. He has restored so many times before. And every single time things haven't turned out the way I wanted them to or I thought they would, I have walked away because I have allowed myself to remain submitted to God through that process, and submitted to God through those seasons, and connected to him. And I'm not saying it's easy. There are times where I'm like, I don't know where you are and what you're doing, and I am in so much pain. I feel so far from you, and nothing about this makes sense. And do I even want to be on this earth anymore? I mean, I'm not minimizing the pain of those hurts and those seasons. But at the end of the day, what I have seen God faithfully do time and time again is restore, is put me back together again, pick up the broken pieces of my life. And if I let them, use them, every single one of them, for good. And I am convinced that that's what he will continue to do as things go awry.
I think when you grow up in a home that is less than perfect, you try to recreate what you were missing in your home. You try to recreate that perfect world in some other scenario. And just, I don't know if it exists, you know? I don't know if, like, the perfect scenario, the perfect, like, no, exists.
It doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. And I think that's the tricky thing, and it's so compelling to think that it does or that it can. And it's like the thing, like, I've kind of called it like billboard Christianity. It's like, look at this picture of what your life can look like if you just follow Jesus. And it's like this perfect billboard, but it's like that literally doesn't exist. And it's not even biblical. It's like, through the testing of your faith, you'll develop perseverance, and perseverance must finish its work so that you'll be mature and complete and lacking nothing. Like, nothing about that sounds like very perfect or inviting. And, you know, it's not lost on me that I have spent. So for your listeners who don't know, I run an organization called Treasures. We provide recovery services to women who have experienced exploitation and trafficking. I've been doing it for 20 years. It is not lost on me that I have spent 20 years giving to other people what I always wish I had. Right? Like, that we want to see things restored. We want to see what we didn't have restored and things made right, you know?
Absolutely. I feel like there's so much really genuine lasting fruit that has come from Treasures. We work in this space where there's so much brokenness. And I think that the testimony of changed lives, not perfect lives, is so compelling. The idea that, you know, that people could experience such a profound fracturing of their world, of their self, and somehow come through that and out of that and blossom into somebody that can truly be an authentic receiver and giver of love and celebrate life and participate in, you know, life's blessings and live fully. Like, that is amazing to me. And I think what I'm personally just kind of wrestling with is like, and I don't know if you've thought about this at all, but like, in my situation, my parents' divorce was a big deal that happened at 13, and it left me with this, I internalized the message that you're not worth fighting for. The way that my parents' divorce went down, my mom was like, you can choose this or you can choose your family. And so, like, that was like hard, especially as somebody who, like, I really looked up to my dad. It wasn't like, oh, good riddance. It was like,
right.
So I think that for me, like, part of this, a big part of what's fueled me in this work is seeing people out there who share that wound, mm-hmm. who have that wound. Mm-hmm. Of feeling like I'm not worth fighting for. And I just feel, so I think that's a big part of like what's fueled me, is to reach out to those people who feel that and to help them believe like you are worth fighting for and you're valuable. And I think you guys have participated in that work to such a stunning extent over so many people's lives over so many years, and it's incredible.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't say that taking credit for it. I say that like humbly, like, wow, look what God has done. It's so beautiful. And I will say, I would say the first at least 5 years of running Treasures, so I dealt with that same lie. I still do. It's still one of those mental tapes that, you know, it wants to be on replay in the back of my head, and it pops up when I'm feeling vulnerable. So it's just wild how it's like, no new tactics. It's all right. Like, same lie. Right. But I spent the first 5 years of Treasures. I want to show people that they're worth fighting for, and I'm fighting for them, and I'm fighting for them, and I'm fighting for them, and fighting for them. But then what I had a huge and horrible awakening that I was operating out of codependency, that I was prioritizing the wants, needs, and feelings of other people above my own, and that I was fighting for everyone else, but I wasn't fighting for me. And I had this real awakening, and I was a person who found myself drawn to broken people. You know, I was raised in a household where my responsibility was to take care of my mother emotionally, who was a drug addict, and codependency was fostered in me through that relationship, and it was my responsibility at least I felt that way in my household, to care for the wants, needs, and feelings of my mother, to maintain the emotional atmosphere of the house, to make sure that I was always happy and positive so that I could balance out the negativity and the pain and the drama and the trauma that was happening. And that I took that wound with me and I took it into Treasures. And I have to be very honest and say that I began Treasures the first 5 years trying to be a rescuer and trying to rescue people. And when I had that shift and I had that awakening and I went into recovery for codependency and I began to learn about how I was not operating out of altruism, really, because at the end of the day, I needed everyone else to be okay so that I could be okay. And I couldn't be okay unless they were okay. So I was driven by this insatiable thing, right? But when I finally got some recovery, the script for me flipped. And it's like, my number one job is to be self-led. And I need to fight for myself. And I need to be connected to and own and be responsible for my wants, needs, and feelings. I need to have boundaries for myself. And in doing all of that, I'm also modeling healthy behavior, healthy life balance, healthy boundaries for others. But the second piece of that is I need to empower women to fight for themselves. I can't sit here and be in this toxic dynamic where now my job is to fight for you, and that keeps you in the role of victim, because you're never empowered to realize that you are a self-directed person with agency, and you have been a victim, but now you don't have to stay a victim, and you get to stand in the position of taking ownership of your life, your wants, needs, and feelings, and you get to fight for yourself. And I want to empower you in that process. And I feel like God does that for us as well. Like he fights for us, for sure. He fights for us. But he's not going to fight against us and impose his will on us. He wants to empower us to be free thinking, autonomous, you know, people who are in deep connection to him, but are also willing to fight for ourselves.
I read a book. I read it over and over. It's called Keep Your Love On. And I've been reading.
I love it. Yeah.
It's so good. I've been reading a couple others that have some similar themes. One is called Boundaries and the other one is called Codependency No More. Codependent
yes.
No More.
Yep.
And like these three books, it seems like the kind of like the emphasis in one way or another of all of them is this idea of becoming a powerful person. Not in the way that you would think, like not powerful in a narcissistic way,
yes.
Where it's like I control people and narratives and like I move, you know, not like that. Powerful in the sense of self-control.
Yeah.
And powerful in the sense that I'm not going to go through life with this powerless mindset,
yeah,
always being a victim.
Right.
I am going to show up for me and you get to show up for you.
Right.
Like first.
Right.
Like, I get to make choices and you get to make choices. And like, and it's such an empowering perspective.
100%.
And also the most helpful way to help somebody. Like we have this like deeply internalized idea that this very like codependent behavior is somehow helpful to people. Like I'm gonna do all these things to rescue and make sure that da da da. It's like, that is not ultimately helpful. And
yeah,
it's Danny Silk's book, Keep Your Love On, that he had a 15-year history background as a master's degree level social worker. And so he brought in like a perspective that was really for helping addicts. And the idea of helping them is like I get to be powerful in this relationship and you get to be powerful in this relationship. I can't make you stop doing it, but you can.
Right. 100%.
And like, yep. And so ultimately for somebody to come out of addiction, they ultimately have to adopt like that mentality of like, I get to control me.
Right. Agency.
And when that clicks, like that is the path towards somebody becoming sober, free, whatever you want to call it is like. And so I can see both how coming into this space, having that similar mindset and, you know, me very much thinking the same thing. I will rescue, you know, these people who feel the way that I felt and,
yeah,
you know, to some extent still do.
Yeah.
Like, and, but there's this like self-soothing aspect of that, of like, And now just very much more like, I really respect and honor my own needs and boundaries, and I respect your needs and boundaries, and you get to participate in like your own path towards freedom.
Right.
And like, I'm going to show up for you this way, but I'm not going to take control of your life. You know, like,
right,
I can't,
for sure.
Like, I can't, yeah, control you. You can't control me, but we can control ourselves, and we can show up for each other in a way that's like loving and supportive and respectful.
Absolutely. And you think about like in the anti-trafficking movement, how prevalent the word rescue is. People are very drawn to it. It raises a lot of money.
It's the Hollywood, yeah, narrative.
But very rarely in this work is anybody rescuing anybody. The best we can do is empowering people and helping them develop their own sense of agency. And when you think about like the types of people that traffickers prey on are people with, you know, that are boundaryless and maybe vulnerable. And one of the issues that we bump into is the idea of learned helplessness. When people, there's a lot of studies that have been done on this. I'm not going to go into all of them, but when people have experienced so much trauma in their lives again and again and again, they develop this sense of powerlessness, this sense of learned helplessness, and this sense that that no matter what they do, they cannot control outcomes in their lives. And so it puts them in this position of like, it doesn't matter what I do, I can't control the outcomes in my life. You know, it's this concept of locus of control, like where is our control? If someone has an external locus of control and they have that sense of learned helplessness, they think that outside people and circumstances are in control over ultimately the destiny of their life. Mm. And that keeps them disempowered, and that keeps them in a place of victimhood. But when we develop an internal locus of control and a recognition that we actually have the capacity and the power to make decisions that will impact the outcomes in our lives, not that we can control it, not that we're standing in narcissism and thinking we're in control of everything and we're like gods ourselves, but that actually we are empowered and we can make choices and we can operate in choice, and that choice does have an impact in our lives. That's what it looks like to be an empowered person. But when we operate in the anti-trafficking movement out of a place of rescuing, we're keeping people in a situation where they remain with an external locus of control, and they remain thinking outside people and circumstances control my destiny. And the only reason things are going well now is because I have a rescuer standing here that's helping me. And if I don't have a rescuer, then, you know, I can't control my own life. I don't have power. I'm not empowered to do so. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, with Treasures, we have seen such beautiful outcomes is because we really do focus on empowering. Mm. My prayer on the very first night of outreach in 2003, and back then, you know, the anti-trafficking movement hadn't really gained a lot of traction. It existed, but even the language of anti-trafficking or trafficking itself wasn't really available widely to the public. I didn't even understand fully my own experience of exploitation through that landscape. So there wasn't really a movement to speak of at that time. Yes, it was happening. The Trafficking Victims Protection Act had passed and everything, but there wasn't language on a just a day-to-day people level. Mm-hmm. But on that very first night of outreach in 2003, I had this sense that we were partnering into a movement. And my prayer that night was that women we reached in the clubs that night would be future leaders in the movement. Mm. I went in with that mindset. My first steps into strip club outreach were with that mindset. I'm not looking at little victims who need handouts and help, right? And, you know, I'm looking at future leaders in this movement. And literally, there was a woman in one of those strip clubs that night on that route who received a gift bag from Treasures and who later went on to serve as a leader on our outreach team.
Come on.
And there are so many women throughout the years that is the story.
Wow.
That they got the card, they got the gift bag, that they found us online, and they're leading residential programs. They're leading drop-in centers. They're running their own strip club outreaches. Wow. And have been empowered to be leaders in their own right. It's amazing.
In just a few decades, porn has invaded the screens of nearly every household with an internet connection. But few people know the truth about the multi-billion dollar industry behind this content.
Action!
Our documentary miniseries, Beyond Fantasy, rips the mask off of the porn industry. It takes viewers straight into the belly of the beast and brings them face to face with some of the biggest porn producers and performers, as they describe, in their own words, an industry that profits from ethical violation, coercion, and abuse.
The chances, the risks that they take,
are the deal that they make with the devil when they come into this business.
It's a hard-hitting series that exposes the porn industry like no other film, but keep in mind that it does include the use of blurred porn video clips, so we encourage viewer discretion. You can watch the Beyond Fantasy series for free on YouTube or at beyondfantasy.com.
The anti-trafficking movement is still relatively new. It's a couple decades old. And so with any new movement like this, there are going to be a lot of like founder-led organizations, which I think can, you know, there's a positive aspect to that of like really keeping the vision anchored to the like what the founder intended. It hasn't become institutionalized. And of course, there are mistakes that are going to happen along the way. And you learn and you grow and you evolve and you mature, and all of that is to be expected. But in my observation, there are, you kind of, you know, I'm at this point now where I can look back with enough perspective to say that there are organizations, and it's not just anti-trafficking organization, any organization, church, whatever, where you can sort of see over time that they go in kind of like one or of two directions. Either over those years, there's something happening, like not your normal growth experience where you make mistakes along the way, but there's a almost like a cyclical pattern of something just systemically flawed in the culture of the organization that results in piles of human carnage over years. And then around the 20-year mark, there comes this reckoning of like, but you can start to see that build up, and it's like, oh, this was not what we thought. Like,
right.
Or you see this like trajectory where there's mistakes and there's maturity that happens, but there's a trajectory of like positive fruit that builds up over years, where then you look back and you're like, wow, like we had a lot to grow through, but there is this massive, you know, testimony of all these people's lives changed, impacted, empowered. And we just had our gala here recently, and we were just playing these slides of testimonials, and for me it was like very like impactful to just look back and just see like these years of testimony now coming to bear on where we're at today and who we are today. But it, as you were talking, it made me think like there is so much positive fruit that has come out of the work of Treasures over the years. And you can't be in this movement without hearing stories and testimonies about Treasures. And I think at this point, you guys are really seen as a source of credibility in the movement and a standard of how to do this work that is built on empowering people. And I'm curious, you know, from your vantage point, because you have gone through so many personal challenges, how have you navigated those personal challenges, those growth moments, those, you know, navigating and the kind of the evolution and of the organization, and continued to come out in a way that where there seems to be this pattern of just growth? And what do you think is like has been the secret to your ability to navigate the difficult challenges of this work and your own personal challenges and continue to bear positive fruit in this movement and continue to build and grow into like such a powerful organization?
That's a great question. I would say the first thing that came to my mind is starting on our very first outreach a million years ago, 20 years ago, we started asking a question at the end of every outreach: what worked, what didn't, and why? And it was that kind of question that led us to learn about like what's working, what's not, and why. And literally our entire, we do trainings to help equip other people in best practices for outreach and care to survivors of exploitation and trafficking and women in the commercial sex industry. The whole training evolved out of us constantly asking that question, what worked, what didn't, and why. And then me wanting to figure out, okay, what is working and why, and what are the best practices? And I am a social worker. I do have a master's in social work. And I'm the first to tell you, I borrowed a lot of our best practices directly from social work. Mm. I would say that's one thing. Another thing is, you know, I believe strongly in a multitude of counselors. There are safety. I live in a very high degree of accountability with deep, deep friendships who know everything about me at all times. Mm. And deep connection, deep intimacy there, which is so important. It keeps me anchored. It keeps me humble. It keeps me accountable. And I am very aware that people are watching. And what I also know is that, you know, the women who, you know, are part of Treasures that are looking to me, they themselves are also going through a lot of hard stuff. The recovery process is not easy. It is challenging. I don't want to sugarcoat it. It's not, there's no magic wand. There's no fairies sprinkling fairy dust on us. We're having to work it out and walk it out and constantly looking at how did my trauma impact my life? And how is the way trauma has impacted my life affecting me today? And what do I need to do about it? And how can I continue to grow? And how can I continue to heal? And so just as much, I need to be asking those questions of myself just as much as anybody else. And I know people are watching me. And the other thing I would say is, quite frankly, having the work of Treasures to do saved my life, because it's given me meaning. It's given me something to apply myself to during like the darkest times in my life since being a Christian. And there have been some very dark times, very difficult times. I had that to keep me going. I knew that I couldn't give up. I couldn't cave in. I couldn't let my life go off the rails because there's too much at stake. So that's, yeah, I don't know if that answers it, but those are some of the things that came to my mind, and the grace of God.
Those are such good things. And really what part of what I'm hearing in what you just shared is the normalization of what I didn't hear is, I didn't hear you say, well, our trajectory of positive growth and fruitfulness and is due to our perfection.
No. In spite of our imperfection, but our willingness to grow.
Yeah.
And willingness to learn and willingness to be humble and ask the right questions. Like even right now, I've got sitting right here this amazing woman. I hired her. She's our new COO, Ann Sutton. I hired her to come in and look at all of our operations and tell us where we need help and fixing and where we can be more efficient and more strategic. And it's like, yeah, I think that that's important, that willingness to grow and self-evaluate and self-reflect.
It's interesting though, because I think that, well, first of all, I would just say that I really believe in the value of what you're sharing along those lines, the normalization of we're not perfect, we are growing, we can't do this alone, I can't do this alone. Let's normalize that. Let's start there. Then let's welcome in the relationships, the healing modalities, the accountability, the different things that we need so that we can be real about our own need for growth, our own brokenness, our own trauma, and create, in a way, like a safety to mature.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that so much. It's so refreshing to hear, because going back to my own personal story, so I think that what I tried to recreate in my own life was this perfect utopia. And so it started with, in high school, I started this group called The Wanderers. And we patterned our whole life after this era of the 1950s. That at that time, in my mind, was like the perfect era. And it was also frozen in time. So it could never change, right?
No, yeah.
It was perfect and it would never change. You know, this is when I was 16 years old. So
yeah. Thank you for sharing. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
And in a way, our friendship, we had this utopia for a while, and then high school ends, and then it all ends, and it's like, oh no, what now?
Right.
And so coming into a relationship with God, I thought, okay, well now I've found it, and I'm gonna find the perfect Christian, the super Christian, you know. And I'm going to fully invest there. And then that turns out not to be real. So then I find another one, and then that turns out not to be real. And I found myself over some years trying to recreate the ideal that was missing from my own childhood and all these situations. And I think part of what I've discovered in the culture of the church is this presentation that we're perfect, which appeals
to
those of us who are broken, right?
Yep.
Like, I'm broken, you're perfect. I need to go be with you. I need to go be in your church.
Right.
Then I'll be perfect.
Right.
And then like, wait a minute, you're not who you said you were. Like, there's something else going on here. And then like, and then disillusionment starts to set in.
Right.
And those kind of things become like really difficult to navigate. And so I think for me, just your answer is like really refreshing from the standpoint of establishing the kind of culture that actually we can all grow and benefit from. Now, you happen to be working in this anti-trafficking space, but what if our professional workspaces were like that? What if our churches were like that? What if our sports clubs were like that, right? It's so much of our society and our institutions are built on the perception of perfection. They're performance-based. It's, and instead of, hey, we're a bunch of broken people trying to figure this out, and let's compensate for that. And so inevitably leaders become isolated, and they, you know, become lonely. They're trying to live
so dangerous
up to something. It becomes very dangerous. And then inevitably something happens, and then all these people are affected by it, instead of just like accepting and owning our own brokenness, our own need for growth. I just think there's such a profound humility in that. And I think that's part of the light that shines in you and in Treasures, is like, I think what I have just always felt is that integrity. It's not the integrity of my life is perfect. It's not the integrity of I've always made the best, you know, relationship choices or whatever. It's not in those things. It's like, it's the integrity of the humility that like, we need accountability. We need help. We need to care for ourselves as much as we care for others. And I just think that's such a profound thing to model in this current world that we're living
in. Thank you for sharing your experiences. No, seriously, thank you for very vulnerably sharing. And I feel like what you're describing, though, is so human, and it's something I relate to as well, but I think so many of us, and it feels to me like what we're longing for is Eden. We want things to be perfect again like they were, but perfection isn't possible, right? But I think that's what we're kind of longing for, and that's what we've made the goalpost or whatever. But really what we need is the connection with God. And that's ultimately what was the most beautiful thing about Eden, I think, is the undisrupted connection with God. And so we think we want Eden. We think we want everything really perfect. But what we really need is connection.
And that's just, that's what we were created for, right? That's the purpose, the goal of all relationships is connection.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think it's helpful for me just to kind of, yeah, just to be able to work out some of my own disillusionment and things that I've seen and things that I've observed and experienced. And but I also feel such a kindredness of spirit with you guys, because I think we share in common that kind of disposition. Like I bring in people to audit Exodus Cry on every level, and we're constantly, like, our staff is like really thriving, I would say, in the season, and has been for a few years. But we're not done. Mm-hmm. We're like, I know there's ways for us to improve. I know there's like ways to improve the culture, to enhance the experience of people that work here. And it's never going to be perfect per se, but I think just embracing that growth mindset of not just individually, but like as an organization, where and how can we continue to create more health, an even better culture? Because ultimately the people that are going to benefit from that are the people who we're trying to help.
Right.
Like, and instead of passing on dysfunction and perfectionism and idealism and all these things, we're passing on like our own lived experience of how do you care for yourself? Like, how do you be a person who has self-control? How do you, you know, how can you be a person who's accountable and create space for yourself, is kind to yourself? Like, I feel in particular, like, we Christians are so, sometimes can be so hard on ourselves. Like,
yeah.
And, or maybe it's not just a Christian thing. Like, maybe it's just, but I know, like, I can be so hard on myself, and just learning those practices of being kind and self-care. And like, so I think I feel kindredness of spirit with you and your approach to this work. And I'm curious, like, just in having this conversation, this isn't something that we planned, if there's anything else that comes up in you, like, around all of this, like.
Yeah, I mean, I just to like piggyback on what you're saying, one of the things I say at Treasures a lot is like, what our vision and our goal is to empower women to live healthy and flourishing lives. But we can't do that if we're not living that way ourselves. And even just as an example of like, you know, our commitment to that, coming out of the pandemic, you know, so many people are dealing with so much trauma and so much upheaval, all the different, the whole landscape, right? All the things that were happening during that time, right? And very few people are coming out of that completely unscathed. And then we have depending on the season, about anywhere from a half to a third of our staff are also survivors. They're lived experience experts. So we have our own histories of primary trauma. Then we have the secondary trauma that happens through doing the work and just vicariously experiencing the trauma of other people on a day-to-day basis. And I was looking around and I'm like, we all need some help here, friends. We need some help ourselves. So we did a restructure so that I could hire a woman who is a spiritual formation director and a somatic practitioner who helps, is very knowledgeable about nervous system regulation and all things trauma and recovery, and hired her just to come on board and care for and supervise the staff, because we cannot effectively carry out our mission to help women heal and thrive if we ourselves are not operating in a place of health, wholeness, and thriving.
Totally. You have to be intentional. Like, those things are so easy to overlook in this work. It's really easy to become a victim to the tyranny of the urgent, where your whole approach becomes one of obligation, of like, this urgent thing and this urgent thing. And I know I lived in that place for a long time, and people would ask me, how do you do what you do? And I would be like, oh, I'm a machine.
Yeah.
And I actually at the time believed that. I thought I have some rare, unique capacity to just go and go and go and go and never fill my own cup. And like, I really believed that. And like, and really what it was is I had divorced myself from my own humanity.
Yeah.
And you actually have to slow down and become intentional. Like, now I realize, and I, in my just philosophy of leadership in general is like, there is such a propensity for us to prop up individuals as the hero, mm-hmm. right? And like, there can be some good in that. Like we need heroes. We need people to point to that model certain things. And so I get that. But I'm also like at this point where I'm like, look, don't trust me. Like, because it's intoxicating. When you feel that from people, like it's intoxicating. And it's easy to run with and just to put yourself out there in that narrative, in that lens. But I'm like, no, like, don't trust me. Trust my support system. Do I have a support system? If I don't, that's a problem. Right. Like, don't trust me. Trust my accountability.
Right.
Like, do you have accountability? Like, lead with this intentionality of we need a support system. We need accountability.
Right.
Like, we need to create healthy cultures, not just powerful, amazing individuals
right.
that will lead us all to the promised land. And so I love that you guys have done that because it shows a lot of intention in like the time that it takes to really grow this, you know, kind of healthy aspect of doing this work. And yeah, I think I just got my wheels turning. I'm like, yeah, I love that totally. So much. I'm like, I want a somatic. What is that?
A somatic stress specialist. I know. I've been seeing one for myself for 3 years.
Write that down.
Yeah, totally. It's so wonderful. In our staff meetings, we do somatic exercises. It's so fantastic. And it's so healthy because you said something about being disconnected from yourself. And yes, we can try for a season to operate and be that machine. And I am the first to tell you that I signed up for that and I went there full throttle, but at the expense of my own self and being fully disconnected from myself. And it's kind of funny because the more healthy I am, the more realistic I am about my own capacity and my humanity and the less I can do. And it's frustrating as an achiever who likes checking off my to-do list and likes accomplishing things. But I can't do it at the expense of myself. And just yesterday, I was telling the team, like, I had a dream several years ago, and there was this big, I was in a little boat, and I was just in my little rowboat. It was a little bigger than a rowboat, but this beautiful cruise liner went by, and it was gorgeous, and it was so tall and sparkling and amazing. And I just watched it tip over because it didn't have a large enough, I'm not a boat person, so I don't know any of the language, but there wasn't enough foundation to sustain the size of that.
It wasn't seaworthy.
It wasn't seaworthy. And I just, when I woke up from that dream, it's like, I'll be a small boat. I don't care. I don't want anything that's not sustainable. I don't want something big and sparkling and beautiful that's just going to capsize. I don't even know if I'm using the right language here. I'm not a boat person. I'm just saying, I'll take the small, healthy boat. That's what I want. A small, solid, healthy boat.
Yeah. That's so good. I was sharing, we had this gala here recently and the theme of it was the voyage and basically inviting people to partner with us on going on this journey of ending human exploitation and slavery and trafficking and all that. And our like tagline exercise cries until every person is free. And so inviting people onto that journey. But it was based on a dream that I had a few years back. And in this dream, there were two ships in the dream and we were passing by each other. I was on one ship and I was observing the other one passing. And these ships were from the 1800s. So somehow in this dream, I was in the 1800s, it appeared. And as the ship is passing by, so I understand the ship I'm on is this abolition movement. And the one that's passing by represents the church. And this ship that's passing by, I see the people on the ship and they are feasting and banqueting and there's music and there's dancing and there's all this happening. But I understand that it's not like joyful, healthy, bountiful, like feasting. It was self-indulgent.
Like gluttony.
Yes. Like this self indulgent, gluttonous, gratuitous.
Like Hunger Games. Have you seen the scene where they're like where they're all having this fancy feast and then they take the thing to make them?
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like that. And I start declaring to this ship at the top of my lungs, a faith that does not act in the face of oppression is no faith at all. A faith that does not act in the face of oppression is no faith at all. I begin declaring this over and over. And then I look back to our ship as this ship passes. And the faces of the people on our ship were focused. They were battle tested. Their faces were set like flint. They were ready for war. And I understood that this other ship was just circling in this very self-protected harbor. Like they were living in this self-protecting cycle of me and my friends and my little vessel and my food and my music and my little world. And we were going out to, those of us on this ship were going out to sea. We were going out to battle.
Yeah.
And I woke up from the dream and I Google this quote, and it turns out that it's a quote from William Wilberforce.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, a faith that does not act in the face of oppression is no faith at all.
Mm.
For people that don't know, he's a famous abolitionist of the 1800s who was very responsible for abolishing the transatlantic slave trade. And I had this realization in the dream that there is a vessel that appears to be the church that is not the church. And there is a vessel that does not appear to be the church that is the church. And what it made me think of is this passage in James where he says, pure and undefiled religion is simply this, ministry to orphans and widows in their trouble. So this idea of the qualification of our faith based upon our response to vulnerability.
Right.
And yeah. So you may appear to be the most fancy church, yada, yada, and you may not even appear to be a church at all. Search our hearts. What is a true faith? Are we actively responding to vulnerability? So I'm not trying to preach a sermon right now, although it's turned into that.
just it's preparing easy, it's sermon easy to do.
We'll just sermonize
I've
each other here.
I've got a few soapboxes and sermons in my back pocket too. I know. I've
Get
been there.
Get your next sermon ready.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring it back to this idea that God has called us we have harbor seasons to heal, to ground, to those things. But he's called us to act on behalf of the oppressed. He has called us to respond to vulnerability, to go out into the sea and to take responsibility for those forces of evil that are holding our planet hostage and to confront those systems and to help people who are affected by all those things.
Yeah.
Like, and so coming back to your analogy and metaphor is just what I became concerned with is, okay, I know we're on this journey. I know we have a lot of good people on this journey. Is this ship seaworthy? And, you know, I don't want to take this metaphor too far, but I think it's a very valid
question.
Funny
with the boat dreams. I have a lot of them. I have a lot of boat dreams.
Same.
Yeah. Oh, that's wild.
I think it's very valid. And like, so people on the outside go, you know, there's a lot of saber rattling in this movie, but we rescued 500 kids, like blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'll celebrate that. Like if you actually rescued those 500 kids, and that's awesome.
And
like,
did they get the aftercare that they need? And
all
where
right.
are they 1 year later? And
what is the culture like at the organization that supposedly rescued? There's, I think like it's really important to place a big question mark over the seaworthiness of any organization. And I put that over us. And I know you guys put that over you as well. Of like, what are those things that we can be doing to fortify this ship, to make this ship seaworthy? I don't want to burn out in 5 years. Like, I want to do this for the foreseeable future, for years to come.
Yeah.
Like, and it's really, really, really important that the integrity of the ship be tested, that we are considerate of and intentional about building seaworthy vessels, building healthy cultures. Like, and I think my takeaway is, like, I'm going to find a somatic.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to learn. I've always learned from you, and I hope at some point you'll learn something from me as well. But this is the kind of thing that we need in this movement. Like, leaders sharing insights on how can we build healthy cultures to help the people that we exist to go out and help. So I want to give you the last word because we got to wrap this up.
Oh, I get the last word.
Anything else on your heart just this season? Like, what's on your heart in this season?
Oh, are you sure you want to open up a whole can of worms?
I want to open up the nutshell version of it.
The nutshell version of my whole can of worms. Okay, I'm going to go there. I'm going to do it. I got my soapbox out and I'm going to stand on it. Okay.
All right, we get Harmony
a story. I would say stewardship of survivor stories and ethical storytelling is definitely something that is at the forefront of my heart this season and for quite a few seasons. And the nutshell version is, you know, Treasures was built on my story. And I believe that we overcome by the blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony. And I believe that testimony is so powerful and it is so important. And yet I have found that it has not always been healthy for me the way the anti-trafficking movement has engaged my testimony or asked me to lay my testimony on the altar of the anti-trafficking movement in a way that keeps me anchored to the trauma of my past being the most important thing about me. And really kind of elevating trauma and who has the biggest trauma story and how can we wow the crowds the most with the most heartbreaking tale when my trauma is not my testimony. How I overcame my trauma is my testimony. And the fruit that's in my life today is my testimony. And it's caused us to really ask a lot of hard questions as an organization. Number one, I went through a season where I was like, I'm not sharing my story anymore. And I went a year without doing any interviews or anything where I told my story. And I needed to take my story back. Now in a place where I can and I will when I feel led, but I need to feel very empowered in that my story is mine to share when I feel led by God, and it is not a sacrifice I'm willing to place on the altar of anti-trafficking or to divulge to satisfy people's curiosity.
Yeah.
Trauma porn is a term that has been used in this vein. But then as a nonprofit who, you know, is a fundraising organization, that outcomes matter to funders, rightly so. And when outcomes are the stories of people who have been through trauma, but them telling their story can be re-traumatizing and re-exploiting, then how do we ethically engage in storytelling? And I don't exactly know all the answers. And so I'm in a season of going to, I don't know how to do that. I don't know that we can. I don't know. So that's what's in my heart right now. That and recovery. I'm writing new recovery curriculum. I'm so excited about it.
I think what we need is more trauma-informed donors.
Yeah.
We need to educate partners and donors with, like, hey, we understand the things that move hearts and ultimately pocketbooks, but we need to do better. We need to put less pressure on organizations working in this space to show all their cards.
Right.
Like, let's protect the safety of the people that we're working with. And here too. Like, and so that, like, this work can continue and be well funded, but without having to re-exploit people in the process.
Not the expense of the people that I'm here to serve. That's my primary goal. It's if I'm here to serve them and you know, empower and all the things, but if them sharing their story is any way causes harm to them, And it does. It causes relapse. It causes people to then, you know, they're second guessing themselves. Then they're like, oh, did I make an empowered decision? It wasn't fully informed. I didn't know what it meant for my story to be alive online when I'm now looking for jobs and people can Google me. I mean, there's just so many layers to this, right? But I just can't do it at the expense and at the risk of the people that I wish to serve.
Yeah, so that's so good.
I might just be a real small boat.
Well, I hope that, you know, our viewers will be able to connect with your spirit and your integrity and the good work that you've done over these years, and will support you guys and partner with you guys. And you're a real one. I am so grateful for you. You've always felt like such a sister to me in this movement. And thank you for coming and being on our podcast.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You can check out all our podcast episodes, articles, and films at exoduscry.com and join the daily conversation by following Exodus Cry on all major social platforms.